This is the Annex, a sociology podcast. I'm Dan Morrison from the University of Alabama in Huntsville. Today, I talk with media historian Josh Shepard, assistant professor of media studies at the University of Colorado Boulder. Josh is the author of Shadow of the New Deal, The Victory of Public Broadcasting, published in 2023 by the University of Illinois Press. Shepard's book shows us how media makers, trade associations, early communications researchers, and the government ended up creating public broadcasting services like your local NPR and PBS stations. Today on the Annex, activism, advocacy, and the public interest in radio and television. Our conversation was recorded on December 13th, 2023. Josh, so good to have you on the Annex. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, awesome. Josh, I reached out to you about your book because, of course, I follow your updates on the site formerly known as Twitter, and noticed that you were working on this project about public media, an industry that's very important to me personally. I think my life really changed when I discovered KSMU, shout out to KSMU, which originates from Strong Hall on the Missouri State University campus in Springfield. And when I started listening to KSMU, I suddenly had access to news and culture from outside of my own little bubble. Sociologists of media and social movements may also be interested in your work because you develop distinctions that help explain the success of public media in a political and economic context dominated by commercial, profit-oriented media. So thank you for writing this book, and thanks for letting me talk about my history with NPR. As probably many people who are listening to us here on the Annex know about their local NPR station, they may support their local NPR station or PBS station or both. So I want to begin today with a timeline. When were the earliest radio broadcasts in the U.S. meant for the public? How much power or range did they have? And what were the early efforts to regulate or license these stations? What did that look like?
Yeah, thank you for this question. So the earliest relay broadcasts go back to the 1900s or so, and it was a different form of communication. It was more like walkie-talkies almost. They called it point-to-point communication, and there was a lot of open wavelengths by which multiple people could be in it, almost like a chat room, like an audio chat room. And they usually referred to themselves as amateurs at that point in really early broadcasting. So people would go on and treat it like a toy and communicate across long distances and try to understand places that they'd never been through the radio. After a series of regulations, by about 1927, we begin to see the system as we understand it emerge. But before that, there's this moment in which it pivots from the point-to-point communication to what we would call the broadcasting model, the one-to-many model. And that's roughly around 1920, 1921. And what happens is there's this experimentation that's taking place in two distinct spheres. The first sphere is what we would now call commercial media. And so KDKA out of Pittsburgh, which has run through the gamut of different owners over the years, it was CBS, NBC, all kinds of owners over time, often lays the claim as the first broadcast in 1920 with election results. But on the other side of things, the educators at universities, at school districts, at local colleges and technical colleges saw this kind of use for radio by which different communities, especially in rural contexts, could receive equal access to education through this new technology. And it begins relatively, simply. So they're on the air and, oh, there's a tornado coming. They got a report of a tornado. And so they could go on, reach about 20, 30 miles outside of the radius, and local farmers could then know that they got a hole up in the basement or something like that for the 20, 30 minutes until the tornado passes. From there, you get like pork belly reports, for the farmers. Is today a good day to sell? And the auspice of a public service model begins to emerge out of the educational networks that sees radio as an extension of services provided by the state and for communities through local educational institutions. So yeah, by about 1921 or so, you get the very first educational stations. And the first thing that they did was invest in simple apparatuses, so microphone and a transmitter to reach the farmers with coursework. It was instructional. So you have something like, you know, home economics class, and here's how you do a certain kind of cooking. So that becomes cooking shows, you know, for PBS and NPR later. You get, you know, a history class and what it means to travel to a European country or something like that. That becomes eventually travel shows on NPR and PBS. So a lot of the early genres and a lot of the aesthetics around what we associate with non-commercial media begin in an instructional context under this public service rubric. And so what's going to happen historically is that as that vision begins to emerge, and as like the Westinghouse GE RCA vision of manufacturers producing broadcasts in Pittsburgh, New Jersey, New York begins to emerge, you have competition for the airwaves, and that's where the regulation begins.
All right, great. That is an awesome way to segue into the next kind of question that I want us to address, and that's about the players. So who are the major players here, the founders of non-commercial radio? You mentioned some organizations, but which people and organizations were involved, and what were they trying to do, and how do those projects connect to the Communications Act of 1934, which plays an important role in your story?
Yeah, so you get to the early 1920s, and these two distinct visions begin to emerge that have been written about by a few scholars before me, Robert McChesney, Victor Picard, Alison Perlman, in different ways. And essentially, the notion that media should be a public domain, by which there's public forums, by which there's access points to different services, becomes dominant at probably about 100 educational institutions by about 1925. Around the same time, you get the emergence of NBC. And NBC is a derivative of RCA. And RCA is a funny conglomerate in those days. It was a virtual monopoly of everything. It was the manufacturers. It was the patents, which was United Fruit. So, you know, because the banana boats had to communicate which port to go to. So they had the radio communication patents. It was AT&T. They owned all the wires. So they had the entire infrastructure and they had the talent in New Jersey and New York with Tin Pan Alley and vaudeville performers. So you have this moment in which you have this ascendance of a model that has all the money and has all the infrastructure. And then you have another side of it that is very strong in concept, but perhaps is not fully realized in practice yet. And that's the educational side that will become public. And as they begin to regulate around, you know, who should have access on the airwaves, because at the time there was only AM radio and maybe only a few channels per city. So they call that frequency scarcity. It was really difficult to preference one type of content over another type of content. So, for example, there might be early religious broadcasters, which of course eventually took over AM almost completely to today. You have the educators, you have amateurs who still kind of want to play with it, but aren't going to be allowed to by regulation anymore. And you have the commercial broadcasters, and they did something really smart on the NBC side, which was that they not only owned the infrastructure, but they began to take from other successful forms of performance. So you have lunchtime entertainment in vaudeville. All the performances are short. They all have jokes. They segue into singing and then back into something silly. And then they have, maybe some kind of local department store that's advertising as part of the show. And they just plant that right onto radio. And people love it because they know it. They already enjoy it. And it opens this space by which the time can be sponsored within the performances itself. Whereas educators with the public service model were very resolute that there should be no profit model and that no specific third-party interest should have domain over what's happening on the airwaves. Okay, so once you sort of see it that way, the regulation makes a little more sense than it usually does if you look at it direct on, because what happens is the government's going to start just giving away the airwaves to the commercial broadcasters because they had already built the infrastructure. People already liked the broadcasts. And the educators were kind of just talking into a mic about how to cook a pork roast. And it wasn't very good. You know, they didn't have any aesthetics. There was no jokes. There was no conversational style. And by the time regulation hits between 27 and 34, 34 is the Communications Act, they don't really know how to set provisions by which public service can be defined. So they begin to regulate in what they call public interest. And this is sort of the famous moment for film and media studies, for those who are sociologists out there, by which a lot of conversations about the American model begin. And so essentially public interest, and they call it public interest, convenience, and necessity, refers to consistency of technical distribution of broadcasts for an audience that's actually listening. And so what happens is there's this huge head start because of just the sheer amount of money coming out of the manufacturing sector. And by default, the American model begins to take a free market approach instead of maybe a public approach that you find at the BBC, you know, or other countries at the time. And the educators cannot keep up. And so they can't keep up. And in 34, the Communications Act ratifies some previous regulations that I won't dig into deeply here that are very boring, but important. And they lose all, they being the educators, lose all of their frequencies. You lose about 70% of this early experiment in local public service to commercial broadcasters that can just prove time and time again that they can maintain the transmitter, that the people are listening to the live performances. And there's no sense within that legislation about what a public good might look like. It's merely defined in technocratic terms of technical mastery and mere access. And this has really become the grounds of debate of the beginning of a lot of political economic literature that comes after that, and then also a lot of analysis about how this decision in 34 actually creates some of the political system that we have today.
Okay, I have a lot of things I want to follow up on there, and there are certain resonances with things that are happening and have happened, at least in educational technology and broadcasting of lectures and other things. We can get to some of that in a bit. But I want to move to see what happens next. And I imagine that in addition to binging the Annex, many of our listeners also, like me, tune into terrestrial radio, like their NPR affiliate. I already mentioned I'm a longtime continuing donor to my local NPR affiliate wherever I'm at. And your book really takes us on a journey through the archive to discover how several groups over the decades created and sustained public media after, as you say, educational broadcasting really falls off, you know, with around this time with the Communications Act of 1934. So what are some of the turning points after that that lead to the resurrection or the rebirth of non-commercial broadcasting over the airwaves in the US?
Yeah, I didn't quite get to the question, and I wanted to stop myself before I talk too long about like which organizations, but let's visit that for sure. So what happens is in the 20s, as they're experimenting with the broadcasts on the educational side, they form essentially a clearinghouse called the National Association of Educational Broadcasters in 1934. They call that, before that, it's called the Association of College and University Broadcasters, and ACUBS. And they don't really know what they're doing. And almost all of their communications in the mid-20s to the early 30s are like, how do we use a microphone? Like, what does it mean to create a broadcast? And it's almost impossible for us to like recapture that moment now by which they didn't understand how to use a medium, or that a medium didn't have an identity that we can all just plug into and perform with as listeners or as podcasters like yourself.
Like we're doing right now.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in case listeners think that we have a very robust, technologically advanced setup here, I have a MacBook Pro and a set of plug-in headphones.
Yeah.
Anyway, so, continue.
It works. Yeah. I mean, it works. Yeah. And so they begin to, you know, just start a conversation, you know, about how do we make a good broadcast by which the listeners could actually learn from those broadcasts. And frankly, one thing I found repeatedly in the archives over years was that they themselves were unhappy with it. And this is kind of the starting point of, you know, the book, which is that the previous histories had sort of pivoted like commercial versus non-commercial media as some kind of public-private battle. for the airwaves, which is partly true, but not for the reasons I think that it has usually been stated, because you have a fully developed and then you have a fully undeveloped on the education side group that will eventually develop. But it doesn't, you can't really understand the regulatory history based upon simply pivoting two groups in contrast, I think, because in the end, these nascent broadcasters will get pretty good at it and build NPR and PBS in the future. So these groups start to communicate with each other and they say, well, how do we even fill like the broadcast day? We have like three people who care about the station. Two of them don't know what they're doing. One of them kind of does. And they just say, you know, and you just go through like years and years of archival records. And one's like, hey, I got this idea. I'm in Oregon and I'm going to do a broadcast about how you use modern plunk. And you like see this back and forth. So yeah, you heard me right. It's not how do you build modern plumbing. It's how do you use modern plumbing. And it was like an educational broadcast. Like, here's what a faucet is. You know, and this is how rudimentary and sort of bizarre some of the early concepts were. One of my favorite ones is an early activist in educational broadcasters for what they would call set-aside frequencies. So they're not competing with commercial media. Said, I created this great show at University of South Dakota in drama in a low German dialect, and no one wants to listen to it. And I don't understand why they don't like the broadcast. And then you think like that would actually does sound like a really good show. And who's the audience, right? That's the crucial question. Knowing your audience, who's the target audience? And you just get like hundreds of shows like that that were just total failures in that time. And but in that moment, at the same time, these visionaries begin to emerge, by which they're saying things like, okay, University of Iowa, I opened the book with a conversation that's held between a BBC rep named Charles Seatman and a guy at Iowa named Carl Menzer, who essentially had to run the station by himself. And he said, like, what if I could just get some broadcasts from my friends at other state universities, what we would now call the Big Ten universities? And what if we just shared our broadcasts and then we could fill the day with good broadcasts? Because I can only do one per day. And they really begin to run with that model after the Communications Act. But before the act, he literally, Menzer was literally just on the air 2, 3, 4 hours at a time alone with a fiddle, just filling the airwaves, playing the fiddle, because they would lose the license otherwise. You had to have, you know, continuity in the broadcast day, or someone else could fill that time. So they would just give the broadcasts away at the regulatory level. But you can imagine like these early days where you just tune into this AM station and it's like some weird saturated feedback of a single fiddle for 2 hours straight. So the experimental music listener in me thinks it would be amazing, because I would actually listen to that now, you know, just personally. But yeah, but you don't, you have this like sense that the concept of equal access to education was so strong for people like us, but there was so little resources and so little experience at that moment that there was going to have to be some infrastructure building. And the big surprise is the gotcha moment in 34, by which they lose their experimental moment. And the airwaves are just simply given to the commercial stations in that way. And so, you know, real quick before you ask another question, like you have this moment at 34 by which these guys, mostly guys, were experimenting, and then they lose their airwaves. And when they lose the airwaves, it galvanizes them to say, how can we actually take this principle of equal access to education and turn it into a practice that is sustainable? And that's kind of what the book is about. The book is kind of about like the strategies that begin to emerge to materialize the concept that was weak in practice into something that actually met the philosophy of education that they ascribed to at the time.
Well, I'm glad you're bringing it to these Midwestern universities and this philosophy of education, because, you know, the book has features a lot of these large public land-grant universities, not only in the Midwest, but also in Midwestern states. And as you say, forming collaborations, collaborative associations, like in Colorado, Wyoming, Iowa, Illinois, and a few others. And I really do think it's one of those things where like that land grant mission, that idea that the university should be educating all, you know, residents, all adult residents anyway, of a state. And that you kind of have to think beyond the confines of the particular campus, whether that is, you know, in Urbana-Champaign or in Iowa City, or, you know, Minneapolis, St. Paul, or wherever. it happens to be. So can you say a bit more about how those organizations, or really particular key actors inside those organizations, worked to organize public broadcasting in a way that's closer to what we know now, and you know, the problems they had to overcome in order to get closer to that model?
Yeah, so I think, you know, the book sort of begins with that moment after the Communications Act, by which they're kind of reeling at the education level. Like, how does the government regulate essentially against itself to do public service broadcasting? Like, how did that happen? And that's been, a lot of ink has been spilled over a lot of years since then about that question. And I fundamentally agree with a lot of the political takes about it, that it was probably bad for democracy that it went that way. You know, so that's another discussion. But what happens is, I frame it in the book as an evolution from activism to advocacy, which is not supposed to be an objective statement about the characteristics of activism and advocacy, but more of a thought experiment, which is to say, before the act, they had the practitioners that were fledgling, and then they had some trade groups. And the trade groups, which I look at in chapter one, were really good at encapsulating this philosophy of education and why educators shouldn't be in competition with the commercial broadcasters and deserved set-aside frequencies, is what they would have called it. And they actually managed to reach some senators who proposed certain bills. So that would be the case before the Communications Act. All of those rhetorical approaches or lobby approaches fail. And they're totally blindsided within the deliberations around the Communications Act, which I also detail in the book a little. And the commercial broadcasters have these brilliant lawyers who can sort of twist every word to say, well, you say you do that, but we do it too, and we do it better. And, you know, the sad thing is, in some ways, they were right. They were doing better educational broadcasts at commercial stations because they had the talent, the radio talent to do it, even if it wasn't as invested in public service. So what happens is they come out on the other side and they say, instead of merely lobbying, what we need to do is build an alternative infrastructure with an alternative philosophy of media to advertising. And so for me, that's really fascinating that you have this concept that people are not succeeding at, they're not being paid for, you know, they're losing like all the policy battles, but they stick to it and they almost double down on this notion that this is important and it will go on just for decades and decades. And they begin to experiment. And so there are multiple experiments that are chronicled in the book, you know, for example, building localized networks so that like City of Chicago, and so the mountains in the Rocky Mountain towns with the mining communities could have broadcasts are networked into a standardized curriculum. So those are like some of the experiments. Some of the other things that happen are that outside of the educational sector, other groups also become kind of galvanized by what seems like an injustice of cutting off school districts from reaching students. And you get philanthropic groups starting to invest in improving the model. And that really, so especially the Rockefeller Foundation, also Ford and Kellogg in the book a little bit. But Rockefeller Foundation starts to fund all of these best practices experiments, including experiments in how to understand which groups are cognating and learning from educational broadcasters better. And that gets into early sociology. We can get to that later. And then, you know, finally, just the way that the policy language is framed becomes a source of concern for the educators. And they begin to get pretty sophisticated about how they lobby in DC as well. And so all of these things begin to, I would say, like, probably the wrong word, but like congeal into something like a series of parallel advocacies that all have the same goal, but are approaching it from different sectors in unison. And so in that way, it's the book would take what I would call a functional account, because there's no quote unquote great man to follow through the history. It's a lot of different people. And honestly, great man histories are terrible anyway, I think. So yeah, you can't just have like one person and say they're responsible. But it really looks at like these institutional relations and policy relations by which all of these experiments emerge in response to the loss of the signals in 1934.
I think that's really great and super interesting about these institutions and organizations, you know, coalescing around you know, a project. And a big part of your book hinges on the study of mass communications and the Princeton Radio Research Project, which included sociologists like Paul Lazarsfeld. So can you tell us what was important about this project and how was Theodore Adorno involved? I found this a very fascinating part of the story. You tell.
So that's chapter four. That's actually my favorite part of the book, honestly. You never know who's going to be interested in what. But I was working in the Rockefeller Foundation archives, who had funded a lot of this research, and I accidentally came across hundreds and hundreds of pages of correspondence. And it just happened to be from these like supremely important figures, you know, in multiple disciplinary histories. And I just really dug into those for a long time, and a story began to emerge. And so what happens is in about 35, the FCC and the Office of Education say, well, this is preposterous that we have to regulate in ways that we ourselves don't think is actually fruitful for the media system. So the FCC is created by the Act in 34. Responds to the legislation and regulates in accordance with the legislation. But people blame the FCC a lot, but I would say it wasn't totally their fault. They were a new body that had to, you know, follow the rules that they were given. But they don't like it. And so they try to find ways in which they could support external research to improve their own regulatory decisions. And so they come to a conclusion in line with the public interest mandate that they need data, essentially. They need data that can prove that educational broadcasting offers a service distinct from commercial broadcasting and that it's actually effective. And what's so fascinating, and I certainly won't know as much about sociology history as your listeners, is that when I look at the records, they had two areas that were just emerging simultaneous. One was social psychology or mass psychology, and then advertising research. And both used quantitative, what we would now call quantitative methods of understanding how large groups deliberate. And so the project called the Princeton Radio Research Project is greenlit as what they first call Project 15 of a large consortium of experiments that are funded by Rockefeller. There's 16 in total. And they essentially want to understand the effects of the broadcasts on what they would have called adult listeners. And that was really 16-year-olds, because most states, you didn't have to go to school after 16. And so it was really still teenagers by our standard. And they start with a question. It was a guy named Hadley Cantrell. And the question was, what technique can then correlate the production of stimuli, which would be radio content, what could correlate the stimuli upon the responses of the listeners to the stimuli towards learning or action? And what he does is he's given all these records and all of this early data research from advertisers and from social psychology. And he's a social psychologist at Princeton. And he sees correlations between them and synthesizes them into a common method. And so the common method is essentially demography. So you have a group, advertisers are asking about three or four possible identities in relation to a question, usually age, sex, gender, location. And he says, okay, we could then tie this early form of data to pre and post production in radio. So I'm trying to do this really slow because it gets weird. You know. So what happens is he brings on these young scholars to help him out. One's a guy named Paul Lazarsfeld and his wife Herta Herzog, and she's often credited as the originator of advertising research, and he is too to some extent. And they say, okay, we need one more person from the commercial sector. They bring in a guy named Frank Stanton. Frank Stanton becomes president of CBS not too long afterwards. And this team says, what we need to do is know who's listening and in what way. That's what we need to first of all figure out. And within the first year of the project, about 1937, Lazarsfeld, Stanton, Cantrell, and Herzog figure out that the problem was that there was too few demographic categories. And so they say, what if we just ask listeners what categories that they would be affiliated with in their own minds? And they expand it to 15, 20 categories of possible affiliation. And what they find is that, so let's say research is of people in New Jersey, and then they have another group in like Montana, is that merely geographically associating responses to stimuli doesn't produce consistent triangulable results. But if you do it across expanded demographic categories, there's actually more correlation between someone in Montana and someone in New Jersey based upon agreement of those affiliations than there is on the previous models. And then something else happens, and this is why I'm going slow, which is that, and sociologists, I hope, will be interested in this. they realized that the more categories that you have on hand, the more you can actually predict which future stimuli will affect the listener or have a response from the listener in repetition. And so the government loves this. So the government thinks this actually does provide the data that they want to show that educational broadcasters can be successful. So on that side, they meet that criteria. But then they also realize that there's something bigger going on here. And we need to formulate it into a kind of language by which policymakers could get it and it could be used by other sectors. And so they bring a guy over who turns out to be pretty famous in the end to help write that policy language. That's Theodor Adorno, who was also trying to flee fascism, right? So Lazarsfeld's an Austrian Jew, Adorno's, you know, German Jew. And they bring, and so they have that mutual understanding of the expediency of the moment. But then they bring Adorno over to essentially write the policy language for the project. And they've really at that moment created several academic disciplines at once by being able to triangulate demographics, becomes public policy research, becomes advertising research, and you know becomes educational standardized testing research in the educational sector. All of this, like, because of the predictive capacities of the research, because they can do something and see that there'll be consistency in responses in the future within the same categories. And Adorno says, you have quantified the singular embodiments of all of these people and in the process dehumanize them. And in fact, this will become a tool of the state and it will become a tool of institutions to ratify decisions based upon listeners, in this case, agreeing with questions asked. So what Adorno immediately does is starts applying early critical theory to it and says that what they were calling at the moment administrative research is actually a form of reproductive institutional propaganda. And in fact, he was right. OWI picks it up right away in like 1941. This is like 38, 39. And 2 years later, it's already being used by the military. And so, you know, to put the contrast here, on one hand, you have literally this epochal insight that I think is actually very valuable personally, you know, in which mass communications and demographic sociological research emerges. And you also have this guy coming in who's founding a humanistic tradition saying that it provides problems for democracy. And so they fire him. For the project, like right away. So everyone knows that Adorno came to America. They don't really know why historically. So that was one thing I discovered in the book. And they don't understand fully why he was fired. And the answer was he didn't agree to meet the criteria for the project that the Rockefeller Foundation and the FCC and Office of Education were asking him to fulfill. And so even though there's always like these personality disagreements that people refer to, it was actually a methodological disagreement that we still have today, like the qualitative, quantitative battles that we have in our conferences. Like that's like a ground zero moment by which an emerging discipline and institutions and funding apparatuses begin to side with quantitative research in order to answer questions for institutional decision-making instead of critical approaches.
Okay, that's a great insight in terms of Adorno and his trajectory, you know, into the United States, obviously, you know, fleeing Germany. Just for listeners, OWI, I believe it stands for Office of War Information. Is that right?
Yeah, it was the propaganda wing during World War II, yeah.
Yeah, and so, you know, this is the topic or the challenge that Adorno throws down here to this project, as you say, is one that certainly has a lot of resonance with contemporary conversations and other theorists who come after Adorno pick up the critical theory mantle in a lot of ways. Yeah, that's fascinating about how Adorno rejects basically the fundamental framing of the project and says that, you know, you're basically creating categories that have the implication of population control and management, not simply just benign reporting on what people think about a broadcaster or where people's identities lie in various aspects. Well, I'm glad you mentioned also the development of these different disciplines, because I think one effect, as you say, of tying together an education mandate, research on mass communications, and the public interest standard, all that together makes public broadcasting what it has become. But it also helps create the field of communication as the study of media, its effects, and its production. So how much do we owe the field of communication studies to the groups that advocated for free public education over the airwaves.
Yeah, so one argument that the book makes is that there's a symbiosis between these educational broadcasts and the aspirations after the Communications Act and the intellectual history and disciplinary formation that was originally engendered by these government mandates to, you know, provide the data, which together end up, okay, I'm trying to like make it really concise, which together end up persuading the government in 52. So in 52, they passed something called the Sixth Report in Order. And essentially the data created by the Princeton Project becomes appropriated at multiple institutions. And the first communication departments emerge in 1947. At University of Illinois is typically associated as the first program. It was founded by a guy named Wilbur Schramm, and then with another guy named Dallas Smythe, who becomes the founder of political economic research and media studies. And Schramm is a mass communications media effects researcher of note in that field. So, but by 52, they have the data, and when they're going to regulate for television, they pull upon this early communications research as evidence that it does work. It's sort of that straightforward in a way, is that moment by which the government and philanthropic groups are asking for research about the topic. It sort of takes on a life of its own. And the entire discipline of mass communications research begins to invest further and further into understanding how opinion is formed. It's sort of that straightforward, which something sociologists do so well, of course, right? And then they develop right after the war something called the two-step flow model with Elihu Katz and Lazarsfeld, which is to say that the situation by which deliberations are made individually are always in reference to the communities or affiliations by which people self-identify. Obviously, in other words, it complicates quite a bit. It's not just that you have all these categories and you see correlations between them, and that the more refined those categories get, the more you can actually predict the behavior. It's also that you begin to understand the situations by which opinion becomes situated and ritualized over time. And so that's what communications studies is obsessed with in the 40s and the 50s, is refining that basic insight into further and further like detail. And so similarly, on a parallel track, they take that information, and Frank Stanton becomes president of CBS, and they apply it to what they simply call R&D, research and development. You get pre and post production on broadcasts. You get survey research. Robert Merton was also a Lazarsfeld collaborator at Columbia after that. And from a sociological perspective, to my understanding of the field, you know, you have essentially a parallel track within the industry by which demography is used to then edit and develop stimuli, as they were calling it, or content, so that it reaches everything from mass audiences to niche audiences. Mm-hmm. It's the same exact methodology. And in the industry itself actually becomes founded on predicating audience responses based upon its assumptions of demographic categories who might be interested in the advertising that will be, you know, mixed within the radio and television broadcasts, which they usually call flows. And so essentially what happens is after, you know, the war, is that this model, the sociological model of public policy research, becomes applied and really intertwined with not only this public broadcasting advocacy moment, but much wider into the understanding of media per se and what it does. And so one of the arguments I make in the book, once again, is that you can't really understand media in the US unless you understand advocacy for public broadcasting and it's how its strategies actually engendered entire disciplines and sectors as part of the practice. Now, public media is going to do something different, which is it's going to really stick to its principles, and its principles are going to be informational access and educational content. And in the 50s, you know, they'll get better at it with TV, essentially. They'll use R&D, they'll have funding from the Ford Foundation, in the equivalent of literally low billions of dollars of investment over about 20 years into developing good content. They'll start to work more with the BBC. And, you know, and public media will start to take this distinct role as what they call the fourth network approach, which is to say non-advertising. So they never give up on that, the non-advertising, you know, stipulations of it. And then, you know, just like trying to figure out how to turn it into educational entertainment. And so educational entertainment is the same cooking show but Julia Child and the super charisma, you know, and that you actually do learn and you're laughing along with her as she's cooking things. Or you get like, you know, Masterpiece Theater and a proto versions of that, where you have what they would have at the time called cultural uplift because they're exposing Shakespeare, you know, all those kinds of content.
All right. Well, I'm glad that I guess I'm glad to know that sociology and sociological tools made such a important impact across all these disciplines. I had always thought that things like communication studies were in some ways, you know, offshoots of the things that some sociologists were doing. So I think there's some support for that idea. I want to close out, I think, with my last question, and it really follows from what you just said in terms of education, but also earlier aspects of our conversation. And have us think about the idea that public media is important for fostering and sustaining democracy. So you write on page 83 about a 26-part radio series called Americans All, Immigrants All, which was broadcast by CBS. And W.E.B. Du Bois and Elaine Locke, among others, were consulted on the series, which was meant to showcase contributions from a wide variety of American racial and ethnic groups, including Black Americans, Jewish Americans, Irish Americans, and so on. So what are your thoughts about the current state of public media like NPR? Do they still have an important role to play in our democracy? And if so, how might that be done in this age of streaming, podcasts, social media feeds, and the obvious challenges of funding for public media in a difficult time?
Yeah, so the concept of that every type of listener should be represented in non-commercial media, no matter how big or small, because you're not looking for advertising dollars, goes all the way back to the 20s. And then with like the works projects you get during the New Deal, you have these experiments in that, like Americans All, Immigrants All. And there's a really famous book written by Barbara Savage at University of Pennsylvania that really details that text. And I think I would advocate for people to read about the history of race in early radio through her important work. But, you know, at the same time, this gets to the heart of one of the things about what I would call sort of soft reproductive ideology that you find in public media. So for example, when you go into early Amos and Andy notes, you know, for NBC, which was a minstrel performance that was in fact the most listened to radio show for decades in this country, it's overtly racist in every way. I mean, the development notes, just like, how could you make a caricature more offensive to make it more funny? When you get into public media notes and educational media, you know, internal correspondence and ledgers, you actually don't find any language like that, because they had this concept of equal access to education at least 20 something years before Brown versus the Board even. But when you also look at who's working on these projects, it typically will stratify in the ways that the listeners will immediately expect. You know, it's typically middle class, some degree of privilege of, you know, being in the academy, white. There is actually better gender distribution than you might expect as it goes along, but really still along certain experience. And it really creates what I talk about in the intro of the book, a kind of omission or like a silence of different groups more than a direct attack upon those groups. And so when we think about educational and public media, we have to take seriously that its high aspirations were still of the contradictions of U.S. culture and still emulated and reproduced those to a large extent. So you have these experiments, and Americans All, Immigrants All is actually a really interesting and sort of beautiful program at times. And then there's, you know, you have Alan Locke on it and Du Bois on it. But then it also has these other moments, you know, that are very much not fulfilling what it had hoped to fulfill in there. And the history of having an exclusive group build an infrastructure, in contrast, you know, to other commercial voices, but nonetheless within the dominant framing mm-hmm. of information and ideology at universities and the segregations that went with that over time, I think created a precedent within public media. And I think to this day, I mean, you're constantly hearing about people of color in public media resigning, being paid less, having a miserable time working in public media, all while this early concept of equal access to education still resonates as a driving force. And one of the points I like to make, you know, about the book is that there's no reason for public media to exist unless it's non-advertising, and we see it as based in a mission statement. It is a mission statement approach to informational exchange. It is not merely a genre. It produced genres, but it isn't just simply a genre. Otherwise, it's just commercial media. And so it really has a deeper ethical obligation to expand into questions of diversity, but also in decision-making, not just lip service on these things. And so, next step on that is, well, what about podcasting, I think, right? And in some ways, like, that original mission statement is more possible because of podcasting. You could have an audience that's super niche and specific of 35 people, when you don't have to worry about what they call appointment listening or appointment viewing, which is to say everything's on at a certain time of day and there's only so much time in the day. So when you can listen and do whatever you want while you're listening and any time you want to listen, some of these original concepts actually do become more materialized, at least in potential, I think, within the system. So I think NPR has just a huge amount of talent coming through it all the time. I mean, they're really, obviously, I'm strongly in support of public media as a democratic enterprise. And then you have this very lofty goal that, if you look at it through a political economic lens, has never institutionally fully realized its own aspirations. And in fact, I think at the administrative level, at the national level, there's even resistance to it because of the way funding works. And they're afraid that they'll get funding cut, by the right or by Republicans if they gesture too strongly towards justice issues. And I think that there was quite a few failures during the Trump administration because of that in reporting, even just the both-siderism and those kinds of things. So, yeah, so I think that in a sense that we can't have a democracy without a third party regulating the discussion, with a third party regulating the discussion. You can't have Fox News become the default public sphere. We can't do it. So all the problems with public media that we all as academics, I think, identify pretty regularly just in our listening, are within the fabric of the institution. That's why they're so hard to weed out. But at the same time, like, if we don't have NPR, if we're just against NPR because of its failings, you're essentially saying to the Murdochs that you are now our public sphere because you've got more listeners. And they're gonna just simply attract more advertisers for that reason. So I'm very idealistic that we need NPR, we need PBS, and we need more. We need community media. We don't need gatekeepers all the time. We need people in the community broadcasting, and we should be listening to them, even if they're terrible broadcasters. So community media, low power FM, all of these things are actually the experiments that define democratic exchange.
Well, I'm really glad you drew together some of the origins of NPR and the pervasive, you could call it pervasive, sort of white middle class, heteronormative kind of style and aesthetics that we see today. A long time ago on the Annex, I wasn't a host at that point, but my co-host, I think Joe Cohen, had a couple of people on, and one person was talking about accents on NPR and how NPR has a particular kind of voice that you can tell as you're surfing through the dial. And if you stop on an NPR station, there's a certain kind of tonal quality to it. It's been satirized on SNL and other fora as well. But now that the workforce is at least a little more racially and ethnically diverse, the sign-offs can be more non-standard, shall we say, or less white, actually, in terms of their inflection. But yeah, that's super fascinating, and I'm glad you're raising the historical and systemic points here.
Yeah. So I think, there's been in the last 10 years some gestures that are quite promising. The shows are excellent, and and there has been more representation, as NPR claims that it should be having. But also the retention is still poor, is what I would say, is that it actually mirrors the Academy in a lot of ways too, in the ways that we have these lofty sort of ways we talk about what we do, and then we just refuse to implement it when push comes to shove sometimes. So I think that there's the potential is so high though. Like we can't give up on education. We can't give up on publics. And we have to affirm the counterpublics within the publics and make them a part of the public. I mean, otherwise Fox is just going to take over. We can't just resist the public. That's sort of another argument of the book, because it's a concessionary politics. you're giving it away to the people who are going to steal it. You know, we have to have better democratic strategy. And I think that's what media can play a role within.
Okay, awesome. I know we're coming up against some time constraints here, so I want to move to just one banter item. And I understand from your account formerly on Twitter that when you travel, you like to sample regional foods. And so, as I was telling you before we got on mic here, we're doing a little food segment and banter these days. So tell us about a recent travel experience and what did you eat while you were there?
Yeah, so I'll put on my other hat here, which is local foodie, food hat, where I just, you know, big talk from about the public sphere. But then, like, you know, I was just in Baltimore, like last week, and I just want to say, like, crab cakes in Baltimore are a unique contribution also to American democracy and cuisine in that way.
Good, good.
Yeah, but you got to, like, go to Baltimore and eat food. I think we have numerous regional cuisines in this country, but only a few that really begin to define themselves as, like, emblematic of something original in the U.S. And you have New Orleans, right, is probably the best overall. You have, like, some of that Midwestern cheese and bread hearth. So I'm from Chicago. You can hear my voice and, you know, and that kind of stuff. But Baltimore is, like, they invented the fish fillet sandwich in Baltimore, the fried fish sandwich with American cheese on it.
No way.
They invented what became Arby's. The pit beef is what they call it, you know, where you have, like, a roast beef. It's cooked over charcoals. It's not barbecued. It's cooked over charcoals, and then they slice it into a sandwich and they put on what they call tiger sauce, which is essentially just horseradish and, like, some lemon and pepper and some mayonnaise. And you put it on a roast beef sandwich, and it's got to be one of the best sandwiches in the world. You know, I put it up there with the Philly cheesesteaks. But then the crab cakes. And the crab cakes are anywhere from 5 to 11 ounces of lump crab, as they call it. It's blue crab. And with Old Bay. And how did they discover Old Bay seasoning? Like, I don't think Old Bay is that great on food usually outside of the crab context. But with crab, it is the perfect combination of flavors that could be imagined for eating seafood. And so you just go there and you get these gigantic balls of crab with no filler, full of Old Bay. And you begin to realize why Baltimore is so eccentric, you know, is because you just ate a giant circle of crab. It made no sense. And there's this bizarre spice blend in it. And yeah, so I love Baltimore. I'm out in Colorado now. I was in DC for a while. And they have something called green chili out here that I'd never eaten really. It's chile. It's what they call hatch chili.
Yeah.
And apparently, I've learned this from people out here, I've been told at least, that, you know, there's no citrus out here. You know, there's no citrus out in arid sort of high plains. So though it's something like 3 times the vitamin C in those chilies than you get in an orange or something.
Really?
So it's the source of preventing scurvy, I guess, for a long time. And they make this, like, soup out of it, and then they put it in everything. And so they put it on top of things, they put in burritos. And so I've gotten super into breakfast burritos with green chili in them. And I got to tell you, as a Chicagoan, and Chicago has amazing food that I grew up with, I don't know how that hasn't made it around the rest of the country, because it's so simple. You can pre-make it. It's on a shelf. Yeah. What's your favorites?
Well, I mean, speaking of green chili, is like, so I used to live in Abilene. We live in Huntsville now. And every year there was the hatch green chilies would come to town, and the supermarkets would actually roast them in these big giant metal drums outside of the entrance to the market. And so you can get fresh roasted hatch chili peppers at the HEB or the Kroger or whatever. And so it was very interesting, because many of the restaurants would advertise, like, hatch green chili products. But yes, it is curious that these are not more widely known outside of the kind of West, Southwest. But yeah, you can find the green chilies that are canned in the store. I just imagine they may lose something in the translation. But I'm with you on the breakfast burrito. Abilene had several hole-in-the-wall breakfast burrito places that were quite good. We just moved to Alabama, and apparently there's an Alabama barbecue sauce that was pioneered by this guy who lived in Tuscaloosa and created that his place called Dreamland Barbecue, and it's a mayonnaise based barbecue sauce because he was specialized in chicken, and so he thought that the other kind of barbecue sauces, the tomato based ones or the vinegar based ones, weren't working well with chicken, and so he combined mayo and maybe lemon juice and pepper and a few other things to make Alabama white barbecue sauce, which I've not yet tried, but I'll do it. I'll do it for the podcast for sure.
I got to try that now. The next on the trip. Yeah. The other thing I discovered out here was Kansas City barbecue, driving between Chicago and Denver. And let me tell you, that is some good living. So,
yes. Well, a previous guest from the University of Missouri, Kansas City, also mentioned Kansas City barbecue. And so everyone will have to listen to Michelle Smirnova's episode here on the Annex. It should come out just as soon as we can get it in the hopper. Well, Josh, thanks so much for your time. I really appreciated this conversation and reading your book. So thanks so much again for being with us on the Annex. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to The Annex, a sociology podcast. I'm Dan Morrison from the University of Alabama in Huntsville. Special thanks to my guest, Josh Shepard from the University of Colorado in Boulder. The Annex is a production of the Queens Podcast Lab of the City University of New York, Queens College. Joe Cohen directs the lab. Thanks to Lena Orsa, who provides the music, and to our fabulous producers here in Huntsville and New York. Thanks so much, everybody. See you next time.